You are listening to the Brennan Center Podcast. Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.
Hello, everybody, and for those of you who I haven't had the chance to meet before, I'm Michael Waldman. I'm the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. We're really thrilled to have the chance to talk with you and with colleagues about the remarkable moment that we're in, where there is cross-ideological, cross-partisan, and intense focus on what can be done to reform our criminal justice system and address, in particular, mass incarceration. For those of you who don't know, the Brennan Center is a law and policy institute, a nonpartisan law and policy institute affiliated with NYU School of Law that focuses on reforming and revitalizing, as we see it, the systems of democracy and justice. We were started 20 years ago by the clerks and family of the late Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, take our charge, not his specific views, but the idea that central to our understanding of the law, among other things, is the notion of human dignity. And that is a value that, of course, is endlessly under challenge when it comes to our criminal justice system. We all know the magnitude of the problem, the over-criminalization, the over-incarceration. We also know that there are really extraordinary social and real-world factors that have helped bring us to this point, crime plummeting over many years, while simultaneously kind of growing in plain sight a huge, unprecedented explosion in the prison and incarcerated population. The statistic that always brings us up short is the fact that we have in the United States 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prison population. And that if you took all the people who are in prison right now, actually incarcerated, it would be the 36th largest state in the United States. Those are facts hiding in plain sight in a way that have caused people from across the political spectrum coming at this from all kinds of different approaches, all kinds of different reasons to start working together in new ways. I can't think of any other issue where there's this kind of work happening. This issue of mass incarceration is very central to us. It is also, and so we published a few weeks ago, among other things, a volume of solutions where leaders from the criminal justice expertise world and from the political world, including, of course, many of the leading presidential candidates of both parties, actually put pen to paper and said what they would do about criminal justice reform and mass incarceration. It got a lot of attention. My co-editor on that book, the leader of our criminal justice program, Enimai Chetiar, is here on this call, and joining us is somebody who was extraordinarily helpful to us in bringing this book together. John Malcolm is one of the country's leading voices on criminal justice. He's the director of the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, which is, of course, the conservative flagship organization. And it has been a great pleasure to work with Heritage, with other leading conservative voices, and on this issue. So the first, we're going to really look at this sort of in the past, present, and future. How do we get to this rather extraordinary point? What do we think could happen now in Congress with reforms and changes over the next year or two? And what do we see as a possibility going forward? So let's start, Enimai, with you. How do we get to this point?
Thank you, Michael. So I would say I think that there are three trends that have really worked to come together to push forward the momentum on criminal justice reform. The first that you flagged was the reduction in crime. And I think that that has created some space for more rational policymaking and to more rationally think about how to respond to crime. The second, ever since Michelle Alexander released her book, The New Jim Crow, there has been an increasing awareness of not only the existence of mass incarceration, but also of its extraordinarily harmful effects on communities of color and on the country. The third trend, I would say largely driven by the fiscal crisis. States, you know, across the country, mainly I would say conservative states starting with Texas, South Carolina, Georgia, have started to pass reforms to reduce their prison populations. And this effort in states has largely been driven by conservatives in state legislatures and conservative governors. And what we've seen is reforms that have provided some relief in terms of trying to stabilize some parts of the prison population, but we have yet to see the real bold action needed to reduce mass incarceration. And two things, I think, have changed in recent years. In the last year, obviously, as we all know, the protests that have been happening in the wake of the tragedies in Ferguson and Staten Island, as well as Baltimore, has really put criminal justice reform on the map in terms of the affected communities really calling for criminal justice reform. The second trend that I think has happened in the last less than a year. So last fall, President Clinton actually predicted that there would be a competition among presidential candidates for who would have the biggest and part of solution to reducing mass incarceration. And so what we really try to do with this book is to get the presidential candidates on record to be weighing in with their policy solutions to this problem. So now we have not only a grassroots movement, but also I would say a grass-tops movement really to bring this issue to the center of public debate.
That's fascinating. Thank you. All of those are so unusual. John, what in your view is sort of the conservative take on how it happened that we got to this point?
Sure. Well, first of all, Michael, I want to thank you for inviting me to be on this call. It's a real pleasure to be with you and NMI. You know, I guess one of the exciting things about watching this right-left coalition is seeing and hearing everybody's different perspectives on how we've arrived at this point. And I suppose I would say that many of us see the same problems. We don't always see them as being problems for the same reasons, and we don't always come up with the same solutions. So, for instance, you've used the phrase, both of you have used the phrase mass incarceration, and I recognize and acknowledge the statistics that you mentioned. But, for instance, I don't use that phrase. You know, I personally think that in terms of enhancing public safety, we should be locking up the right kinds of people for just the right length of time and no more. You know, I see people approaching this issue from the perspective of race, which NMI mentioned. There are some on the right and on the left who stress human dignity, as you have, and saying that we have not put enough emphasis on the potential for rehabilitation for people. A lot of this is budgetary, as NMI mentioned, particularly at the state level. I'll mention that in a few moments again. And also there are some of us who just believe that we lock up too many people for too many things. Many things that are now labeled as crimes are, in fact, people commit acts that are not inherently blameworthy. You know, a reasonable person wouldn't necessarily know that they are committing a crime, but Congress or a bureaucrat or a state legislature has, in its infinite wisdom, labeled something a crime, and sometimes people get caught up in that maw and get prosecuted for committing, you know, these acts. And even for people who commit acts that people recognize as being inherently morally blameworthy, some of us feel the pendulum has swung too far, and we lock these people up for too long. I think really how we got to this point, in addition to the fact that incarceration rates were going up at the same time that crime rates were falling, is that a bunch of states discovered that prison costs and prison construction and prison maintenance were usually the second largest items on their budgets behind Medicaid and that prison growth and maintenance was on an unsustainable path. So necessity being the mother of invention, a lot of governors in red states, blue states, and purple states started experimenting, and some of those experiments have proven quite successful in that they have been able to reduce their prison populations, and crime rates have continued to fall in those states. And I think that that has caused people to look at this a problem anew. And instead of going in with a sort of a knee-jerk assumption that if you lock up more people for longer periods of time, crime will fall, that perhaps there may be better, more humane ways of addressing this problem.
It's such an interesting thing because this is, of course, an issue that for decades, really since the 60s, has been very sort of fraught. It's been politically polarizing, and people have sort of looked over their shoulder a lot. Do you see, how, I ask both of you, how has it been the case that people have, in effect, been able to take some of these reform steps in the states and places like Texas without it becoming a political conflagration? Are there, you know, on the right, for example, are there evangelical communities or libertarian impulses or others that really have the back of political leaders to do this? And how does the involvement of conservatives affect the calculus of progressives or Democrats when they work on this?
You want me to take a stab at that, Inamai?
Sure.
Well, you know, look, I think that you were right in that people were, one of the third rails in politics were people afraid of being labeled soft on crime. And this is painting with, by hyperbole, you know, that Republicans were always sort of ratcheting up penalties and that Democrats were always trying to loosen penalties. And so the Republicans would go in and beat up Democrats for being soft on crime. And there are exceptions to that, of course. They're tough on crime Democrats. So I realize that that's painting with a broad brush. But you did have a bunch of very conservative governors, like Rick Perry and Nathan Deal in Georgia, and, you know, I forget her name, in South Carolina. You know, all of these very, very conservative states that took these steps that gave some cover to people to be experimental in these areas. And what's more, they not only reached out and touched the third rail, but these experiments have proven to be successful. And you now have people like John Kasich and Nathan Deal who ran for re-election touting what they had done in terms of prison reform, and they won re-election handily. And so I think that gives people a fair amount of political cover to go out and try new approaches.
That's really interesting. And my own background in politics was with the Clinton administration, and as I tell my colleagues here, I do not personally use tough on crime as a pejorative, in the sense that I think that if crime were as high now as it was then, a lot of people would have a different approach to this. They would be much more concerned and maybe not as willing to try some of the new innovations. Inamai, you worked in state advocacy before you came to the Brennan Center and saw how some of this stuff has played out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what John said is exactly right. So once conservatives started leading the charge, not only did that give cover to other conservatives, it then also gave cover to progressives. The one thing that I did see in states as this was playing out, that when conservatives were sort of leading the charge, progressives were still a little bit hesitant to come to the table. And so I think one of the outcomes of that is that a lot of the reforms that were passed in states were not quite as bold as they could have been. I mean, I think the other reason for that is that as long as these deals were sort of worked out behind the scenes in state legislatures and there wasn't a public or political conversation happening about the issue, there wasn't enough momentum, like there wasn't enough cover to really kind of take the steps that were needed. And now I think that's changing. Like I think we're seeing bolder reforms come out of states as this is now becoming a part of the national conversation.
So let's turn our gaze a little bit Mark Twain said there's only one Native American criminal class, and that's Congress. So it's perhaps appropriate that we ask about Congress. And again, it is this extraordinary spectacle of Mike Lee and Cory Booker and Rand Paul and Dick Durbin and Ted Cruz, you know, in a variety of ways, having either jointly sponsoring bills or really working on this. Yet at the same time, some of the kind of old bulls, some of the longer-serving leaders seem more nervous. What do we think is a possible range of things that could happen over the next year or two so that this doesn't become just, oh, yeah, remember that wonderful time when it looked like everyone agreed and then nothing happened?
Well, I'm very optimistic, I have to say. And in part, I remain a happy warrior when it comes to this because, you know, Congress is, to use an expression I don't like using in other contexts, leading from behind. I mean, they're looking at all of the states that are doing all of these things, and these things are proving popular even in red states and purple states. And so eventually Congress comes around. I mean, they can see when a political message is selling well and when people are, in fact, reducing incarceration rates and crime rates are continuing to fall. They're going to take notice of that eventually. One of the things that is very, very exciting to me is the breadth of issues that are being discussed in Congress in this area. So soon there's going to be legislation introduced to address mens rea reform and regulatory crime reform. There are sentencing proposals that are out there, mandatory minimum reform proposals. I refer to those as front-end sentencing reforms and back-end sentencing reforms like the Corrections Act and whether somebody can earn their way to a reduced sentence. There's proposals out there for asset forfeiture reform. There are proposals for policing practice reforms. There are proposals out there for collateral consequences and alternatives to incarceration and specialty courts. It's a whole breadth of issues that are being discussed, each of which has some bipartisan support. Now, it's funny because, you know, some groups really like one type of proposal and really oppose another type. So it's difficult to see exactly where things are going to come out. But I do see that on many of these issues that there is a sweet spot there where people can come together and will come up with, I won't say they're solutions, but I would say that they are certainly steps in the right direction. They are probably more than some would like, some of the old bulls that you referred to, and less that perhaps we on this telephone call would like. But nonetheless, it will be progress, and when you couple that along with the continued reforms that are taking place in the states, you know, I'm pretty bullish about all of this.
Enimai, let me ask you to bring in that other three-ring circus, the presidential race, where this issue, again, has taken on quite an extraordinary new role. And you and your colleagues, I can say with pride, just did such a remarkable job in persuading all these presidential wannabes to put their ideas out. And I know that wasn't such an easy thing to do. How do you see this? Do you see this as something that is going to continue to be front and center in the presidential campaign, or how can we make sure that it continues to be front and center?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good question. So I see kind of two challenges here. One, are the presidential candidates going to continue to agree on the need for, you know, whatever you call it, reducing mass incarceration, reducing overcriminalization, or generally speaking, reducing the size of our criminal justice system? Or is some thing going to get in the way and create a polarization where people kind of go back to their own parties and dig their heels in? I think that the consensus around this will probably stay, and I'm pretty, I don't want to say certain, but I'm pretty sure that's probably going to happen. I think the more important question is whether the issue is going to continue to be part of what candidates talk about and whether the prominence of the issue will raise, right? So, like, right now, maybe it's number 20 of the issues of what presidential candidates are talking about. The goal is to try to get it to be on the list of between, you know, the top five or top 10 of what presidential candidates are going to be speaking about. Is it going to come up in the debate? Is it going to continue to be an issue in the election? Is it going to be something that people might potentially vote on? I think the way to do that is to keep, not only A, keep the candidates talking about it, but B, also to continue to have a media campaign where there is pressure put on these candidates and where they feel that they have to talk about this. So I would say I think this will stay part of the debate, and to the extent that we can really try to work to keep it high up on the list is where we'll really be able to seize the opportunity.
I mean, in a way, of course, you can see, you know, as a political matter, Hillary Clinton gave her first major policy speech after announcing her candidacy and after visiting Chipotle. The next place was to go talk about mass incarceration, and there's sort of some separate and apart from the policy of it, there was an understandable political rationale for her too, given the intensity of the feelings in a lot of Democratic voters on this stuff. It's interesting too to see, given how many cross currents there are on the Republican side, and you're starting to see occasionally criticism, for example, from Rand Paul of Marco Rubio on drug policy and that sort of thing. Whether those kinds of issues will become division points in the debates or not. I have a question for both of you, and John in particular. I think I'd be interested in your view. We've talked about the issue as over-criminalization, over-incarceration, whatever way one wants to talk about it. But of course, one of the ways this has become such a flashpoint is around issues of policing, and both policing generally, but also the highly publicized incidents in Ferguson or in Staten Island or Baltimore that lead even to protests and violence and a very kind of intense conflagration running on cable TV over and over again. How do you see that stuff happening on the street affecting the prognosis for action in Congress or in the presidential race? Does it help or does it hurt, or is it the wrong question?
Well, look, I never think that horrific incidents like what happened in Baltimore and in New York and in Ferguson and, you know, are horrible in terms of innocent lives being lost, but then the horrific aftermath, the rioting and police shootings, I rarely think these things help. I will say that what they do is to serve to highlight a real problem, which is that there's a big gulf between law enforcement community and how they're reacting and interacting with certain communities, largely communities of color, and anything that spurs a dialogue in which hopefully people will not just be shouting at each other, but will take a sober, calm look at the actions not only of the other people, but of one's own actions. That can end up helping to bridge that gulf. But, I mean, there's a real problem, so I suppose that what's good about it, if you can find any kind of a silver lining, is that it's highlighting an issue that would otherwise be just, you know, an undercurrent. And if it's something that's brought out in the open, you at least have a chance to try to discuss the issue and repair the torn fabric that we have seen in these different communities. So, yeah, I think that these incidents are a reality, and I think they're going to be part of the presidential election. I don't know how much they're going to sort themselves out in terms of the proposals that are floating around in front of Congress. But, you know, look, I suppose I'll even take that back. So you're seeing the president talk about selling of military-style equipment to police officials. You're talking about body-worn cameras. Those are all being debated on Capitol Hill, and there may be legislative proposals related to that. And clearly, incidents like Ferguson and Baltimore are feeding into those discussions.
Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.